Ksuvas, Perek Dalet, Mishnah Dalet 4:4, and this Mishnah first discusses the various zechuyos, the rights that a father has with respect to his daughter. We're talking here about a daughter who is either a katana or a na'ara. After she becomes a bogeres at 12 and a half, then she's her own woman, and he has none of these claims on her. And then we'll talk about transitioning to being the wife of another man, how he has certain additional rights beyond those of a father. So the Mishnah says, Ha'av zakai bebito b'kedusha. The father has the right to get whatever financial benefit there is with respect to her getting married to somebody else, accepting kedushin. So that means that while she's still a katana or nara, whatever financial interest there is in the marrying the daughter, the father gets. So if the husband says, you know, give me your daughter as a bride and I'll give you, you know, two camels. So those camels belong to the father, not to the bride, but the father has a right to get that. And that's true, bekesef, bishtar, uvavia. Whatever means of kinyan the husband is using in order to effect this first stage of marriage called kedushin, erisin, the financial benefits, the perks, go to the father. So that means if there's a ring going to be given, so to speak, the ring actually goes to the father, that's kesef. Shtar means the actual contract, the piece of paper that says that they're getting married, that this commitment's happening. So again, that contract might be worth something, you know, if you need it as a cork to plug into your bottle of wine or something. So, you know, corks cost 10 cents, so this is worth 10 cents. The point is it's the father's 10 cents, not the daughter's. The same goes babia, if, although it's us or Midrash Rabbanan to do so, if the father makes the arrangement that the way in which they'll affect this marriage is through bia, he will sleep with the daughter to affect the kedushin. So then, again, whatever their concessions made with that, like the two camels, whatever it is, so those camels are going to the father. In addition, he has three other zechuyos, which we'll enumerate now, all of which pass on to her new husband. So those three are v'zakai b'mitziasa v'maasi yadea v'hafaras nedarea. He has the rights regarding what she finds, what she produces, and the annulment or the cancellation of her vows. So let's talk each one in turn. Mitziasa means the things that she finds. So if she finds a $50 bill on her walk outside, that $50 belongs to the family. She should give it to her father. She can't keep it for herself. The reason for this is a takanas derabanan. The rabbis were concerned of eva, resentment, enmity between the father and daughter. Since we're counting on the father to feed his daughter, and he does that out of his own, normally speaking, out of his own free will and out of his, you know, good graces, he takes care of the daughter. So what we don't want to happen is that the father resents the daughter and refuses to provide for her, you know, food, clothing, etc., which might happen if he was resentful because she found something that he wants, but she won't give it to him. And therefore we say that whatever she finds, the rabbi said, should go to the father. That being the case, that's how Rashi learns. That being the case, hypothetically, if the girl's not being supported by her father, she's independently wealthy or she's moved out or who knows what, so then she isn't supported by him and therefore not concerned about him cutting off support, and therefore what she finds is hers to keep. That's how Rashi learns. Tosfos point out there's really a different reason to be concerned, which is since the father has the rights to decide to whom she gets married, he could, in theory, if he's, you know, vindictive and angry at her, he could marry her off to a manuvel or mocheshchin, someone who is ugly either on the inside or the outside. And that being the case, she's sort of vulnerable to him, so we don't want this vulnerability to be exploited, which might happen if he's resentful, and therefore we want to minimize any resentment, any eva, so therefore whatever she finds again goes to him. According to that pshat, according to Tosos pshat, that would apply even if she's no longer living in his house or being provided food from him. Second of all, Masi Adeha means what she produces with her hands. Again, that refers to both any product or labor she produces. That means if she's waiting tables as a waitress, or if she's building tables in her little home table-making factory, the proceeds, meaning that, you know, her wage as a waitress or the table she's producing, all go to her father. That's learned out from the basic calculus that if he is authorized and empowered to sell her into servitude and get money for that, so he certainly has a claim to whatever production she, whatever she produces as a worker or a laborer, until she's 12 and a half years old. And third of all, he has the right of hafaras nadara. He can cancel her vows. That means on the day he hears that she took on to whatever it is, no longer eat meat or something, she takes a formal vow, I'll never eat meat again, meat's forbidden to me. So then he can say, no, I'm canceling that. And then from the cancellation on forward, she's no longer bound by that nether. That's in contrast to the hataras nadarim, which is done by a bezin of three or even one expert who would retroactively say that the vow was never binding, but that requires like other maybe Pesach or something. It requires some sort of harata that they can only under certain circumstances can a chacham undo her vow, but a father can undo under any circumstances on the day he hears of it. So those three things, he has special rights in his daughter until she's past 12 and a half. In addition, umakabel es gita, he is able to accept a get on her behalf in order to sever her marriage. Again, remember we're talking in this whole section here about a girl who is not yet nesua, she hasn't married another man and moved in with him. Once she does that, she's her own woman and she belongs to the new household and her father has no claim or rights over her or jurisdiction over her whatsoever. But before that happens, meaning if she's just done a rusa, she has just been the first step of marriage, so she's legally married but not functionally married. So then there's a drasha. The drasha is v'yatza v'haisa, which basically boils down to the fact the same way that she gets into marriage, she can go out of marriage, and since the father can accept the kedushin on her behalf, he can accept the get on her behalf. So that means if you have a woman, or girl, I should say, who's 12 and a half or less, who was mukudeshes, but then her husband has second thoughts and wants to divorce her, the husband can give the get to her father, and her father can receive it on her behalf, and then she'll be automatically, even not as a shliach, just the father will receive it, and she'll become a divorce, so he can accept that. And finally, ve'eno ochel peros b'chayeha, he, the father, cannot eat or benefit from her assets even at all during her lifetime. So that means that if you have a situation in which this girl somehow managed to have some assets of her own that don't belong to her father, so for example, let's say that her mother dies, and after her mother dies, her mother was an only child, and let's say she's an only child, so then after that, her mother's father, her maternal grandfather, dies. Since the maternal grandfather has no other children, and she's the only heir, so she would inherit her grandfather's farm. So now she owns the farm. The point of her mission here is she owns the farm, and eino ochel peros b'chaya, while she's alive, her father has no claim on that farm and can't even, you know, get any benefit from, you know, he can't sell the apples that grow on the farm, etc. If she dies and she's still living in her father's home, so then her father will inherit her like any child who has no spouse or children of their own. So it'll go to the father. But that's only once she dies during her lifetime. He has no use or allowed to use of the farm that was hers. In contrast, nisses, once she gets married and now lives as a wife with her husband, yasar lav habal, the husband has additional rights in addition to what the father had. So aside from those three that the father had, which were enumerated before, that what she finds and what she produces and the ability to cancel her vows that the father has, the husband also has. In addition, the husband has other rights. For starters, he's she'ochel peros b'chaya. He will be allowed to have that usufruct benefit. He can be ochel the peros of the even the nechsim malug while she brings to the marriage. So the farm she inherited from her grandfather. Now the husband may take the apples that grow on the farm and sell them and use the proceeds for himself while they're married. V'chaya b'mizonoseha. He, the husband, is obligated to provide for her mizonos, her food, and also her clothing and medical attention, etc. So, and that's an obligation. Some learn that's a doraisa obligation from a pasuk, from Sheir Ksusa V'onasa, and others learn it's a derabbanan. But in either case, for sure, the husband is obligated to provide for his wife. And also, b'fir kona, he has to be a porek, he has to redeem her if she's being held ransom. So he has to pay the ransom to get her back. That's an obligation all to itself. More about that in Mishnah Ches. But he has an obligation to, he can't just walk away and divorce or something. He has to first pay the ransom and get her back. U bikirvos bikvurosa. He has to be, he must pay for her kvura, for her burial. So that's both the effort of arranging for the burial as well as paying for whatever costs there are involved in the funeral procession, acquiring the funeral plot, etc. It's all an obligation that the husband has to his wife. Now, on that last point, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, afilu ani shebi Yisrael lo yifchos mishnei chalalim umekonenes. Rabbi Yehuda says, even the poorest poor person, poorest Jew, still has no fewer than two flute players and one like kind of professional crier as part of the funeral procession. The idea being that the flute playing sets the mood, and then you have this professional konenes, this woman who's like wailing, that since she's crying sort of, plus the flutes playing, everyone's kind of start crying, and that's the mood that they want to create for the burial, that everyone should, you know, be sad at the loss of their loved one. So Rabbi Yehuda says that's a bare minimum. Now the machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda here is something kind of technical, which is, what happens if her family's custom is to not have these flute players in the konenes, but his family's custom is? So the rule is that it's called ola imo. She goes up in social status with him, which means if he can afford it, because he's wealthy relative to where she's coming from, he'll have to pay for his own family minhagim, even if her family's minhagim were different. Which means we're saying that even if her custom was in her family, don't do this flute playing, etc. If he can afford it, he has to. Now, according to Tanakhama, that's true when she's alive, but when she's dead, that obligation of ola imo, that she's, you know, rises up to meet him in terms of his social status and financial status, falls away. So then the husband now is entitled to say, listen, her family's custom is to not have these professional funeral flute players and crier, and therefore I'm not going to pay for it. We won't do that at the funeral because that was her family's custom. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. He says that this principle applies of ola imo applies even after her death, which means if he can afford it, then he certainly has to do the funeral procession in a way that meets the standards of his family and his side of the family. And at all events, no matter what, that would mean, says Rabbi Yehuda, no fewer than two flute players and one professional wailer. And if he could afford more, he'd have to do more than that as well. The halach on this last point is that Chazal required him to arrange for her kvura in exchange for the fact that she's bringing in whatever, you know, dowry she's bringing in. Therefore, he has to pay for everything according to the standards of what could be afforded. So he has to pay for her, you know, of course, her matzeva, her funeral stone, and so on, as well as at least these, if it's the custom of the place where they live, if it's normal, he also then has to also pay, regardless of her family's custom, for these flute players and the mourners. But nowadays, since that's not really customary anyways, of course, it doesn't apply.